This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Energy Week, episode number 4, was recorded on Wednesday, May 29th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. This week's expert panel includes Saxo Bank's commodity chief, Ole Hansen, commercial broker, Pat Hemsworth, and former market regulator, Chris Cook. Topics for this episode include, as Chris Cook put it, off the air, there's been a disturbance in the force. What the hell just happened? And what's coming next? We're going to focus on that in just a minute. EIA data was delayed by a day this week. It won't come out until Thursday because of the U.S. holiday, so we don't have an inventory report to discuss. So let's go ahead and jump right in and meet this week's expert panel. Ole Hansen is head of commodity strategy at Saxo Bank and joins us this week as a first-time panelist. Ole, it's been quite a week in energy markets, a real roller coaster ride. Please give us the overview of what has happened. What are the events that have shaped the market in the last week?
Well, hello, Eric, and thank you very much for having me. Well, I think the market is still just trying to recover from that double punch it received last week, last Wednesday, before your recording, we had the EIA report basically showing an increase in U.S. stocks, and the market didn't take that lightly. And then really what happened was we had a bit of a sucker punch the following day when the Huawei ban was announced. The market went into a tailspin, probably led by the weakness, renewed weakness in the stock markets. And just highlights really right now, we have, even though we've been trading sideways now for best part of almost 2 months, there's some very, very big opposing forces right now in the market, pulling it in opposite directions. No doubt that the supply cuts from OPEC has been very successful so far, adding to this the geopolitical worries in the Middle East. But now I think increasingly the market is starting to really to get worried about the trade war and its impact. We're having a potential risk of the trade war not being the solution to the trade war, not being the medicine that the market is looking for, because the economic data as they are coming in now is increasingly pointing towards an increased risk of recession. Just take a look at the spike in bond prices, lower bond yields this week, curves are flattening, Fed funds are pricing in now a 50 basis point cut within the next 12 months. We think it's probably going to be within the next 3. And this is really just now leaving the traders in a very confused and situation where I think there are a lot of people are just opting to trade these markets on a very short scale, because going short is dangerous because we still have these spike risks in the market. But overall, I think still we got this very skewed curve where we've got a very elevated backwardation. We've been talking about this in the past. It's quite interesting that the backwardation goes up when the market goes down. That's normally not how these markets are supposed to be functioning. But I think it's to a certain extent indicating that we're having the physical players right now, those who can see the tightness, they are holding on to the front, while those who have never seen an oil barrel, who only use oil as a proxy for the macroeconomic outlook, they are keen sellers right now, but that's probably taking place further out the curve. I think that's really it. The market is, I would almost call it directionless right now, but we should not ignore that there are some really big forces right now. From a technical perspective, the breakdown last week, we took out the 50-day and the 200-day moving average. That did attract some short-term selling. Since then, we've been trying to recover. But I think right now, the market is, to a certain extent, been taken hostage by the stock markets, because the market is looking at the stocks for guidance towards the potential impact of for further clues of how the global economic outlook is faring.
Okay, thanks, Ole. Really glad to have you on the panel this week as well. So welcome aboard. Pat Hemsworth is a commercial broker with Paragon Global Markets, and her decades of experience in both the paper and physical markets give her tremendous insight into the dependencies that exist between those markets. Pat, Ole just mentioned the OPEC production cuts. Now, in less than a month, the Saudis and the rest of OPEC Plus are going to meet to decide their strategy going forward. Until recently, most people thought they were going to renew their cuts and so forth. But they're walking a thin line now, because to balance supply, geopolitical tensions, and economic factors and so forth, they've kind of adopted a wait-and-see attitude until now, maintaining that production cut stance that they had agreed to many months ago. But what choices are open to them as they construct a strategy going forward? We've certainly seen a pretty big sell-off here that brings a lot of people to question whether or not they can continue with that. Expectations seem to be still for a rollover of the existing cuts. Will they abandon their 1.2 million barrel cut strategy in light of fears of an economic downturn, or are they going to stick with it?
Thank you very much for that question. I think that, you know, just echoing some of the things that Ole has said, right now the Saudis will really need to look at, I think one of the things that they're really worried about is the demand side of the equation. We talked last week and we've talked recently about how the physical markets in the United States and in Europe, in product markets, most of the product markets last week, except for U.S. distillate, were all backwardated, as well as WTI September or October onward, and certainly Brent, all backwardated. So what we're seeing, you know, are physical markets that are where there's enough supply, but there's a short-term kind of tightness that's reflected in the spreads. But it's almost as though what happened, you know, since Thursday was like a structure just collapsed in place, almost like a floor of a building collapse, where the term structure kind of remained the same and tight, whereas the flat price just collapsed. And so I think going forward, the Saudis and OPEC really do not want to have a repeat of what happened last year. And last week, we were talking about the speculative participation in the market, how it really wasn't the same as it was last year. Well, last year, you know, at this time, the speculative long position in WTI, for example, was massive, and the open interest was almost 2.7 million barrels. And so, you know, there was this real excitement going into the period when we're talking about, we meaning the United States, was talking about ending, reimposing sanctions on Iran. And so there was this real excitement. The physical markets were relatively weak at that time, but the spreads and the term structure was relatively weak, but the flat price was just soaring. And then after that, as we remember, the United States, issued waivers to a number of different consumers. And then on top of that, in response to pressure from our president, the Saudis and OPEC increased production. So this all happened at the same time that U.S. shale increased its production pretty sharply. And so the entire mix was a collapse that we saw around Christmas. And I think more than anything, they do not want to repeat that. And so as a result, you know, they came up with this agreement to cut 1.2 million barrels last December. And they've been pretty much maintaining that while, you know, the Iranian situation has changed again. There's no waivers. And the Venezuelan situation has deteriorated markedly. So the choices that they have are basically to roll over the existing agreement, but one of the things that they're looking at what we're concerned with here today, which is the demand side of the equation, and whether or not the trade war and what monetary policy will be going forward. So their choices basically, they'll come down to rolling over the existing agreement or increasing their production to make up for the losses from Iran and Venezuela. But right now, it's unclear exactly what they're going to do. And I think, you know, as we all summarize it, it's a very nervous kind of picture that we see right now.
Okay, thanks, Pat. Chris Cook is a former market regulator with decades of experience in energy markets. Chris, we had you on the program last time, and in passing, you mentioned the phrase U.S. energy dominance. Now, I know from my own following of your work that you've written quite a bit about that. So I'm going to ask you, just for the edification of our listeners, to elaborate. What is it that you mean specifically when you use that phrase, U.S. energy dominance strategy?
Well, thanks very much for having me on the show again, Eric. My specific subject, I suppose you could say, is very much these days strategic issues and market strategy and looking at the big picture. And I first came across the energy dominance expression not long after President Trump announced, I think it was 29th of June 2017, he announced the new, let's call it doctrine or strategy. I think it was at the Energy Institute, and I think in Washington. And he didn't really say very much about what it was, and it took a little bit of time to sort of work out from events in the market over the next few months what was going on. And don't forget that every president has a strategy or a doctrine. Some talk about it and some don't. So energy dominance, literally 2 days after he announced it, Saudi Arabia abandoned B-Wave, you know, their pricing mechanism, the Brent weighted average on the Intercontinental Exchange. They abandoned that and went on to, I think, Platts Window. And literally, again, within days, we saw, I think, something like 1.2 million barrels long position built on the markets. And we also saw at the same time, during that 6 month period, a ramp up of the price from $45 a barrel to maybe 75 or so. And I don't think that was disconnected. We saw a massive influx of funds into the market. Now, where did this come from? Well, you'll recall that President Trump took office in the January of 2016, and he had two guys on board who I wouldn't have thought he took on board. One was Gary Cohn, who was the architect of the Intercontinental Exchange back in 2001. And of course, you know, Mr. Tillerson, who, you know, big oil, you could say. So the two of them came on board, and I have a feeling that they must have been behind the strategy which became known as energy dominance. And the idea was, I think, and is, for an essentially mercantilist approach by the US to actually take, you know, to start to dominate the market, to actually, you know, ramp up the production of oil, shale oil and gas, which they did as the price went up. And, you know, production went up at a phenomenal rate as a result. And this has led to an extremely aggressive posture. We see, for instance, the US, you know, looking to sanction Germany and the EU for daring to, you know, for the Nord Stream pipeline. Well, on the one hand, you've got the sort of ideological view of Russia. And on the other, you've got them as a market competitor, which is it? And I think President Trump being a sort of commercial beast, I think we're looking at a completely different sort of strategy by the US here. When it comes to oil, again, we actually see the US and its production of shale oil. We heard from Anas, he's very good on the way in which the massive influx of light oil is affecting the dynamics of the global energy market. In particular, you know, gasoline glut and so on. And I'm sure Pat will probably have a lot to say on that. So what we've seen is that the US are exercising, the strategy is to exercise, you know, dominance of market prices. Now, on the other side of the picture, we've seen the $30 a barrel increase, and it's gone higher still. This is something which I think, A, China is not happy with, and we can get on to China. And B, it's basically, and this is in Ola's terms, we're looking at $1 trillion a year of additional energy costs on a production of 100 million barrels. And that's just oil. Never mind what happens when it's refined and then seeps into the rest of the into the global economy. It must run to many trillions of dollars in increased costs. So I personally think that massive increase of the oil price caused by this, or driven by this energy dominant strategy, I think it has a huge effect. The thing is that the US isn't that worried because it can print the dollars always. You know, it's a fascinating geopolitical strategy.
Okay, thanks for that, Chris. We'll be back with our discussion topic right after this. For our panel discussion this week, we had some discussion off the air, and I think Chris put it best when he said, look, there's been a disturbance in the force this week. And I think it's very clear to all of us that there's been a roller coaster ride in markets. But what's really causing it? Is this driven by inventory and exacerbated by the China trade situation? Or is it driven by the China trade situation and exacerbated by inventory? Or could it be that the market is directionless and it's taking its cues from the stock market? Because frankly, if I look at the action in the last couple of days, it seems like the S&P is leading WTI, and unlike the usual action where RBOB tends to lead WTI, it seems like WTI and stocks are coming first and RBOB is reacting to them. tail wags the dog. If I look at this from a technical analysis standpoint, you could make an argument that today looked like a reversal day. Maybe we're headed much higher. At the same time, you could also say that we had a breakdown in a bear flag pattern that broke last night, and now we're coming up to retest that trend line and perhaps about to move much lower. So what the heck is going on here, and what should we expect next? Chris Cook, let's start with you. What do you think is driving this disturbance in the force? As you put it, you get to go first since you coined the phrase. And where do you think we're headed from here?
Well, I think the market is inflated. I think it's inflated financially by quite interesting off-market means, which I've described in the past as the big long. I think that it is fragile. It's not a particularly sort of resilient price. The risk of it's algo-driven, in other words. Certainly it was, you know, for many, many years until B-Wave ended. It was certainly algo-driven. And it's likely to break down rapidly. And, you know, you get a flash crash. So I think we see these long, steady increases in prices, and then all of a sudden you get flash crashes. And I think that on the one hand, we've got an upper bound of what I would call a seller's market, which, you know, I think we are certainly at. I think the limit is $75. And frankly, that's way, way overpriced. And on the downside, maybe there's a buyer's market sets in below $50 a barrel or less. But I see that the risk is on very much on the downside. The market could go way lower. I think there is a serious risk that the Chinese just, you know, pull the bid, take the bid out of the market, stop buying. But that's getting on to the trade war point, and we can talk about that as maybe during discussion.
Pat Hemsworth, you sit on a commercial trading desk every day, so you see the order flow going right by your screen. What's going on here? Is the moves that we've seen in the last few days, are they being driven by oil and energy market fundamentals, or is this a case of larger, broader macro drivers like what's happening with the China trade deal that is influencing everything?
Well, I think that the market has really been, if we look at crude oil prices, they moved sideways for 3 weeks in a very narrow range in low volatility, while stock market was forming a kind of dark cloud over everything. And the trade war talk continued, and also we're watching the dollar, and the dollar was extremely strong. And at the same time, you know, where Ola mentioned earlier about the prospect for a rate decrease this year, and we're also looking at them for next year. So I think that, you know, you had asked about the tension between inventories and inventory growth or whatever driving this drop. No, that's really not the case. It's like the same story. You know, we're still doing the same spreads in gasoline. The gasoline spreads are pretty much unchanged with all of this. In fact, the crack spreads were pretty stable. They didn't move usually. I mean, they probably were a tiny bit stronger, but, you know, all of the internal webs of relationships that sort of drive the commercial trade did not change violently. They still remain relatively stable and strong. We could say that, well, the real back end of the market sort of fell apart, you know, in terms of the forward curve. But the front end remained relatively steady. And we did come off quite a bit this morning in the WTI time spreads in the front end of the market, but they rallied right back on the close. So I think that this is not a fundamental story in that, you know, it's supply driven or inventory driven. I think it's more the fear of an economic slowdown that caused the market really to fall out of bed. It was pretty stunning Thursday. And I'm really seeing this as a nervousness that derives from uncertainty as far as the overall economic growth. By the way, JP Morgan and several other banks came out with a 1% projection for growth in second quarter, which is kind of unbelievable. And, you know, so that's made people pretty nervous. And then I think the final break, you know, today we gapped down in the S&P 500. So that just extended it. So Did you say, Eric, that the S&P is kind of giving us, or maybe Ola said it, that S&P is giving us signals that where the oil market is looking to from the demand side? So, I mean, these are kind of the things that I've been thinking of, but it was quite shocking. And, you know, and I'm not really seeing huge changes in the underlying structure of the curve, except for the back end of WTI.
Let's move on to Ole Hansen. What are you guys seeing at Saxo Bank?
Well, I think this week, just like 2010, we had to get used to strange words like scandium, yttrium, cerium, neodymium. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing it correctly, but these are all rare earth elements. The announcement by China early in the week that they, actually it was overnight, that Chinese media was reporting that China could potentially step up the trade war by blocking the export of these rare earths to the U.S., which is many parts of U.S. Industry rely very heavily. And I think that was really the step up we saw this week that helped weaken the price once again. And adding to this also, it seems like we've had a bit more conciliatory tones coming from the White House with regards to Iran. I think Trump's appetite for a conflict in the Middle East is very low at this stage. He's got an election to fight in a year, and I think U.S. electors, voters are more concerned about gasoline prices at home than fighting another battle in the Middle East. So I think on that basis, some of the geopolitical risk premium may also have deflated a bit this week. Today has been a little bit of an opposite day where, just as Pat mentioned, we had seen the market try to recover, even though the stock market are still on the weak point. But I think the overall, the market is really looking for direction. I agree with Chris that the downside risk, once we get these supply worries out of the way, I think the downside risk poses a greater threat than the upside, because also what will that do to OPEC discipline if the market starts to drop once again? And with the slowdown, we have been looking for 1% growth in the second quarter for a while, and I didn't see those forecasts, Pat, but if some of the major banks are starting to talk about that, then that is indicating that the data as they're coming in right now is not supporting a strong number for the second quarter, and that poses some challenges as we move into the second half, and that's probably going to be met with another round of what we call policy panic, which is just similar to what we saw in January when the central banks stepped away from QT, the Fed did, and they halted their interest rate rises. And as I mentioned in the beginning, the trajectory of Fed funds right now is only looking for 55 basis points over the next 12 months. I think that's way too little. We wouldn't be surprised if we see a 0.5% cut by October and potentially another 0.5% before year end, because I think the market is really not getting their head around the fact that we are in a slowdown, and that potentially could get a lot worse before it improves. And we have to remember that central banks have run out of ammunition in Europe. We are sitting duck. We've got nothing left in the toolbox. The US can cut rates once again, but into this, if there's a stampede for dollars, that will only make the matters worse, because a stronger dollar is not what the world needs when it's starting to weaken, especially when we're seeing quite a lot of that weakness coming out of the Far East. So overall, I think the risk is skewed towards lower prices. But again, I think we also talked about before, it's a tricky one to sell, because just in the short term, we could still really easily see that this market spike on some renewed supply threat. But overall, I think we shouldn't forget there is a lot of spare capacity out there which has been held back politically that can come back into the market if it was needed. And as the economic outlook deteriorates, where the $80 was the pressure point last year where macro funds started to sell, even though we had a clear break to the upside. I think that was quite interesting back then. When we broke the $75 level and the market, that from a hedge fund perspective, I used to work for one for 10 years in London in my earlier years, and clearly that was a buy into strength move we saw there. But actually what did happen was that the hedge fund, the cut report was indicating that the net long was coming down before we actually peaked. That indicated to me that macro funds were starting to get worried already at $80 about the potential outlook for the economy. And I think this time around, the world economy has slowed further since then. So 80 is not the pain threshold anymore. It's probably 75 or potentially even lower. So I agree with Chris that the upside is above those levels is quite limited because of the potential acceleration of the negative impact.
Thanks, Ole. Chris Cook, what are your reactions to what Ole just said?
Right. What Ola said and what Pat said, they both chimed with me. One was this point about the movement of the flat price and the counterintuitive move in the flat price and the backwardation. I'm reminded back in 2009 of the super contango, which took place at the same time as the market was going up. Now, that technically shouldn't happen, of course. And we've just seen the converse here of a super backwardation, I think we can call it that, and yet the market drops like a stone. And then Pat mentioned that, well, you know, all the relationships between, you know, the physical relationships between the, you know, oil and products remain the same, and yet the curve falls. And it strikes me that there's something deeply, deeply financial going on here, that what we're seeing is that the commodity curve is twitching with the yield curve. That's what it seems to me to be happening. That says to me that what we're seeing is financial buying down the curve. You know, this is the big question that I've always asked. Who's buying down the curve and why are they buying? And I think it's financial buying down the curve. It's nothing to do with physical. You know, you're not finding refiners buying all the way down the curve. We're talking here about a big financial whale in the market, I think. Motivations are not entirely clear.
Pat Hemsworth, you guys do a lot of work in the physical markets. I know you watch the curves very closely. How do you reconcile this crazy situation? Because as Chris just said, we've got steepening backwardation in the face of almost collapsing front month prices. That doesn't jibe with normal market action.
One of the things that I was looking at before the call was really where we were last year at this time. And it was interesting that the flat price was rallying sharply, and yet because of what was pretty much an oversupply or a heavy inventory situation, the forward curve was relatively weak. And so we saw contango markets. So, in fact, you even mentioned this question last week. Can we, you know, what are we to assume from the shape of the market and the forward curve? And, you know, will this point to higher price action? Well, what we saw in real time Thursday is that these things can really disconnect. But we did see a shift in the curve somewhat, like the back end weakened, but the front end did stay relatively strong. So we'll see. I mean, you know, markets are anticipatory and they try to look to the future, but the current supply situation remains the same. So we're doing the same business, doing the same roles, and looking at the same relationships in the crude grades. You know, they're highly backwardated, like Dubai. Anyway, I mean, yes, they can disconnect. And but I think right now we're just focusing on the fear of an economic slowdown. I really felt like the last couple of days I was just, we were doing our spreads and everything, but we were trading the S&P on a flat price basis. It was just kind of like mirror action. And it was a little frightening today to see the S&P gap down. And that's kind of how we started the day in energy. But it clawed its way back. So we'll see. But, you know, there's a lot of big question marks. And the question marks really derive from where we're going on the demand side, I think.
Ole Hansen, your reactions to Chris and Pat's comments?
Well, it's mostly to Pat's, first of all, because I'm just looking at Brent, because obviously that's where we've seen the backwardation most elevated. First of all, the fact that the market is still worried about the supply being tight here over the coming months, and that's keeping the front the flat price elevated. But it's also just looking at the cut reports, which I love to watch every week. I use it as a, if you look, if I have to cover 20 different commodities, so it's a great radar just to keep an eye if anything starts to get too elevated, and that's when I start to look for either technical or fundamental change. That obviously in corn now, I'm not going too far away from the oil market, but just as a reflection that where we've seen that in corn recently, we've seen that actually in coffee now over the last couple of days, that these things do work. Looking at Brent crude, we've seen this crude oil in general, we've seen just something like an 11% reduction in the combined net long over the last 4 weeks, but the 80,000 90,000 lots has really been primarily in WTI, or 90,000 lots is primarily in WTI, which has seen a 78,000 reduction, 12,000 only in Brent. It does indicate that there's still a lot of longs in the market holding on to this tightness story. So I think just any small change in that outlook, any talk about murmuring about raising production or markets not being as tight as potentially the market is the curve is telling us, could trigger quite a significant risk to the downside, because there would be quite a bit of long liquidation coming in. With regards to Chris's observation about who's buying it, what the producers and the hedges are selling at the back, it's that's a very good question. I have not been able to find the answer to it either. I do note that right now that if you are a macro-based trader who's only using oil as a gauge for the global economy, then you are probably not that keen on being short at the front. You would rather stay a bit further out the curve. So that potentially, I think, has added to regular hedging activities that occurs on a regular basis. Chris mentioned earlier that the algos, and I just want to add a bit of that, because we've been discussing that here at Saxo Bank recently, because there's a feeling that the algo strategies may be struggling a bit at this stage, also even in the energy markets, because we have some really major conflicting news right now hitting the screens, and it's not as if the market is calm and quiet. There really are some serious events of things unfolding behind the scene, and that basically means that the market is very headline driven, and you can just see the news recently about the attack in the Middle East on some of these tankers. In the past, that would have triggered a much bigger move than what we're seeing right now. So I think even the algos traders are having a few issues trying to get the direction right now. And potentially that's part of the reason why we've been, as Pat mentioned, we've been almost been range bound now for the past couple of months. And I think part of that could be the fact that the machine simply cannot deal properly with these major news coming into the market.
I want to ask everyone about the technical analysis aspect of all this, because frankly, I am really at a loss reading this chart. We had a major sell-off in WTI touching 57 spot 34 back on Thursday. We've really seen what looks to me like a bear flag pattern since then. That bear flag pattern broke on Tuesday evening, and we saw this major move right down to about the 34-month moving average at 56 spot 88 on WTI crude, and then a massive recovery today. Now, if I wanted to tell a bearish story, I could say, look, we had a bear flag pattern. We broke the bear flag to the downside. We put in a new low. Now we're doing that classic bounce that you see in technical analysis, where you break a key trend line and you go back and test it from the other side one last time. We're testing right into the close today on Wednesday, that same lower trend line on the bear flag pattern. And it looks like, okay, maybe it's about to go much lower to new lows. On the other hand, you could say today was a textbook reversal day, where there was just really, really aggressive selling in the afternoon and a major rally that ended on a major moving average at the end of the day, right at the close. That's a very bullish sign. So is this a very bullish chart, or is it a very bearish chart? Or should we throw out the chart and look at what the S&P technicals are telling us? Because frankly, it feels to me like the S&P is really what's driving everything at this point. Ole Hansen, you guys do a lot of technical analysis at Saxo. How do you read this? And I'm only looking at the WTI chart. Is the Brent chart similar?
Well, just starting off with the WTI chart, I agree with you, Eric. And actually, if we go back to the middle of April, and then from the bottom in the beginning of May and moving up, we did have another bear flag. And the lows we made last week was basically almost a completion of that move down. So even though, despite all the carnage, there is still quite a lot of technical signals, our market is still adopting some technical levels here. What we see today, WTI probably looks a little bit more promising today than Brent. We're having a nice hammer there, where we are closing right, almost at this stage, closing right in the highs. But I think just from the markets, the way it's been mean reverting now for the past couple of months, the market is probably trying just to take it, see if they can take it back up, at least up to the 60 level here, which is the breaking point. So 60, I think, is probably the most they can hope for, unless we should see a nice strong rebounds in the stock markets into the close. Looking at the Brent, on the other hand, that's where I would say the 50-day moving average comes into play. 50-day moving average was where we found support back in early May. That was actually the day where we had a so-called golden cross. I think that's probably more for journalists than traders who was looking at golden crosses. It's nice, always nice talking point when a 50-day crosses a 200-day. Actually, if you should really be technical about this, it's only valid if both the moving averages are pointing in the same direction, because obviously it's quite easy for an upward moving average to break a downward moving average. So I think that one was the latter. So that wasn't really, and it didn't really create that much, that many headlines. But 50-day moving average was support back in early May. And now just over the past couple of days, this is where we're banging our head against resistance. So that basically tells us that 70.30 right now on Brent. So just a little bit of less than a buck higher here. That's where we got the resistance coming in. But so far, it's pointing towards a decent close on the day, even though we had some weakness in the stock markets.
Pat Hemsworth, you're also on a commercial trading desk. What do you guys see in this market?
I actually have to agree with Ola in that $60, I believe, is a place that the WTI will run into a lot of problems. I don't think we're going to get beyond that. And what really convinced me of that was just the violence and the heavy volume. On Thursday, the volume was 1.6 million contracts on WTI, and the open interest went up. So that was not net liquidation. That was net new selling. We broke violently through all of the supports, the 200-day moving average. You know, and so that isn't just like a little stop loss. It's really a change in the market. So what I'm looking for now, you know, we can have something really change, you know, in terms of like some event, some geopolitical event. We could have, you know, some accident, something that could shift things. But it really looks to me like $60 in the near term here is we're going to run into a lot of resistance.
Thanks, Pat. We'll be back with our second topic, which is Iran sanctions, coming up next after this. The United States is aggressively imposing sanctions on Iran, and there's a lot of discussion about the possibility of this escalating to a military conflict between U.S. forces and Iran. A lot of people are just scared to death that they feel there's no limit to the upside that is possible in oil prices when a war breaks out. I personally have a very, very out of consensus view. I think that the breakout of an Iranian-U.S. military conflict would actually put a price cap on oil, because I think the way it would go down is President Trump would call MBS on the phone and say, look, we're going to strike Iran in the next 3 hours, and if the price goes over $60, we're going to stop striking Iran and call the whole thing off. Make it happen. And I'm convinced that that would be effective. I think Saudi Arabia would love to see the U.S. enter a military conflict with their arch rival of Iran, and I think they would be happy to accommodate the president under those circumstances and make sure oil prices stay low during any conflict. Am I crazy to think that? Chris Cook, let's start with you.
I don't think that's crazy based on the sort of conventional narrative out there about Iran. But I've been fortunate enough to have been there 11 times now to Iran in the context of my work at my research at University College London, most recently in February. And all is definitely not as it appears. You know, the conventional narrative is not the case. The sanctions policy has been, I think, it's been a smart tactical approach, but a strategic disaster in many ways for the US, I think, in that they've succeeded in making Iran much more resilient. They've had to do things for themselves. And in fact, the financial sanctions are the only thing that kept Iran from collapsing economically in the same way that post-Soviet Russia collapsed economically. You know, it really is counterintuitive. Also, you've got a young population. I think there is a revolution about to come in Iran, but it's not going to be a violent one. It's a sort of change in intergenerational thing. But that's just a sort of introduction. When it comes to the energy markets, Iran have always been very, very sort of creative in terms of how they deal with sanctions. And maybe jumping around sanctions. And I observe, first of all, there's some interesting techniques which the Iranians pioneered. We're talking here about oil swaps, for instance, so that, you know, oil from the Caspian into the north of Iran was swapped for oil into the Persian Gulf. That was an interesting technique. They also have swapped gas for power into Armenia, and also gas for gas. So it's possible to do interesting things involving supply of physical oil flows as distinct from actual, you know, sales into the market. But definitely the Chinese have, I think, certainly backed off for the time being. The Chinese are gouging Iran. There's no question about that. My understanding is that Iran is busily putting oil into tankers in the Gulf, as they did before with the previous sanctions. They all the spare, you know, tankers they've got, they just fill them with oil. But sooner or later, the floating storage fills up, and sooner or later you have to decide, are you going to actually sell at the prices that China is gouging, because that's what they do. So we're going to have to wait and see what happens, I think, after May as to, you know, whether or not Iran starts supplying China again and to what extent. And I think India also will be sitting back and, you know, with the peanuts waiting to see what bargains are going. But for me, one of the most interesting pieces of, I don't know about news, but comment, was something by the writer Simon Watkins. It was on oilprice.com. And he was talking about the immense fields which are on the Iran-Iraq border, massive oil fields, which, you know, super giants we're talking about here, structures which are maybe only 5 to 6% exploited when Saudi are getting upwards of 50%. We're talking immense amounts of reservoirs. We're also talking about the fact that Iran supplies Iraq with gas. It's not easy, and gas and power. And the way in which Iran and Iraq are pretty much joined at the hip and have been for some time, the opening up of dialogue between Iran and Iraq, very, very close. We've seen Rouhani go and see the most senior cleric, Sistani, in Iraq recently. And the guy who really calls the shots in Iraq is al-Sadra. They're taking a very, very nationalistic view. And basically, they're not really, I think, going to be biddable by the great powers in the way that maybe some people think they are. So I could see some interesting techniques going on here, swaps. You know, Iran-Iraq might start wondering how much of Iraq's supply actually has some underlying sort of energy swap with Iran behind it. These guys are ingenious, and it's difficult to say whose name is on molecules of oil and gas, still less the electricity that flows backwards and forwards between the regional nations. So, you know, all is not as it appears. These are ingenious people, some of the cleverest people on the planet. And I think the next 3 to 6 months, we're going to see some interesting games involving Iran and sanctions.
Ole Hansen, Iran situation. How do you see it at Saxo?
Well, we haven't got feet on the ground as Chris, so we are a bit more relying on the news as they come in, but also just from a political perspective, so trying to watch it from the helicopter. And as I said earlier, what we're seeing is a president in the US who's not really terribly keen on another intervention in the Middle East. He has been pretty vocal against the previous attempts, and I think this one is similar. Also, because just from the political stage at home, I don't think it's a vote winner. And I'm sure he's thinking quite a lot in those aspects. So I think the risk of conflict is very low. I think that's also part of the reason why we've seen some of the geopolitical risk premium being taken out of the market. And I also agree that there are probably sources outside Washington who are very keen on a conflict, but I don't think they're going to get it at this stage.
And Pat Hemsworth, Iran, what do you think?
I completely agree with Ola, because, you know, I mentioned this last week. I think that if anything characterizes Bolton, it's the fact that he is the biggest Iran hawk ever. And recently, I think Trump has both publicly and privately, which became public, he expressed dissatisfaction with, he does not want to go to war. And Ola is exactly right in that it is truly not what Americans are looking for right now at all. So, and his focus is getting reelected. And so I really think that it's unlikely that we will be a part of any kind of intervention.
Okay, thanks, Pat. I want to ask all three of you, what you're going to be watching for in the week ahead. But first, listeners, we need your help putting the word out that there's a new podcast in town. We do intend to become the definitive weekly podcast for energy traders, investors, and others interested in these markets. So please help us out by telling your friends and colleagues that there's a new energy-focused podcast on the Macro Voices Podcast Network. You can subscribe on iTunes or at macrovoices.com. We're also looking for sponsors so that we can keep all of our content free to the listener. If your company is interested in sponsoring Macro Voices Energy Week or any of our other content, please email me at info@macrovoices.com. Before we close, I want to ask each of our panelists what they're going to be watching for in energy markets in the week ahead. Ole Hansen, why don't we start with you? What are you going to be looking for?
Well, probably not as much the energy market, but what's happening outside of it, because as we have been discussing, the energy market is right now, to a certain extent, taking its cue from macroeconomic developments. And I think on that front, we later in the week, on Friday, I believe, we got the University of Michigan Sentiment Index. We also got some manufacturing PMIs coming out early next week. So I think these are really going to be quite key, because it's going to have a potential impact on expectations for rate cuts, but also the direction of the dollar. And we haven't really talked about the dollar today, and the dollar is grinding high at this stage, and not really, again, that's not supportive for oil price at this stage. So I'll be watching the macro calendar quite closely.
Chris Cook, what are you be watching for in the week ahead?
I was more interested in the geopolitics and what's going on particularly in the countries in the Middle East. Iran is very much the subject of my attention. So events in the Gulf and the meetings which are going on are also very interested. In fact, it's happening in Oslo right now, where I am. You've got the meeting of the Venezuelans are here. So there's discussions going on, or should we say discussions about discussions, in relation to resolving the issues in Venezuela. These are the sort of things that interest me. And yes, they do tend to have a bearing on the oil market as well.
And Pat Hemsworth, what will you be looking for in the week ahead?
Well, I think that we have to be watching the S&P and the economic developments to give us a sense, because of where the flat price of oil is going to go, because, you know, it's really taken its lead recently from that. Also, I'll be watching to see that where we stand in terms of refineries coming back from turnarounds. We're still relatively low in terms of utilization in the U.S. We have flooding, which more and more flooding now affecting the pipelines going into Cushing. So I'm going to be watching that. I'm going to be watching what's happening with our wonderful RBOB and PADD 1, which still has relatively low stock levels and will be expiring in the products at the end of this week. So that's going to be fun. And then also, you know, looking at the flows of physical oil to get a sense about where the EIAs might come in next week. I mean, we're actually going to have the EIA tomorrow, but, you know, I'm also watching the flows for next week. I hear that for this EIA report, the gasoline imports are going to be very low. And we're still relatively low in stock levels in RBOB in the New York Harbor. So that's going to affect our expiration. So we'll see. But, you know, I'm still watching all the energy stuff, but certainly watching the economic news as well and the dollar.
Thanks, Pat. Macro Voices Energy Week is released every Wednesday evening. Next week's panel includes Art Berman, Anas Alhaji, and Tracy Shukart. But before we let this week's panel go, I'd like to ask each of you to please tell our listeners where they can follow your work and learn more about what you do. Let's start with Chris Cook.
Yeah, you can follow my work mainly at my Twitter account, which is CJENSCOOK.
Thanks, Chris. Ole Hansen, Saxo Bank, how can our listeners find out more about what you do there?
Well, just like Chris, I'm relatively active on Twitter, where I primarily focus on energy markets, so crude oil, natural gas, but also metals, gold, silver, copper, and right now with all what's going on in the agricultural market. So, it's a mixed bag, but primarily energy and metals. You can find me at Ollie_S_Hansen. And elsewhere, our website's at Saxo Bank. You can find our research at analysis.saxo. That's quite easy to remember. remember, we do a live broadcast every morning from our studio here in Copenhagen, which goes live at 8:45 CET. So that's minus 6 hours, so 2:45 for you guys in New York. That's probably a little bit too early, but elsewhere around the world, that might be worth your while. We'll just take a look at what's happening the day ahead and what we're focusing on.
And Pat Hemsworth, how do we follow your work?
Well, I'm on Twitter as well. It's at P. Hemsworth, and I'm there posting on different things. So you can find me there. And then if your listeners would like to receive my commentary, I write a daily commentary on energy. If the listeners would like to have a copy, they could just email me and tell me a little bit about their interest in energy. I'd be happy to send it to them. And so I can be reached at phemsworth@paragonglobalmarkets.com. So again, it's phemsworth@paragonglobalmarkets.com.
Okay, thanks everyone. And again, for next week, we've got Art Berman, Anna Salhaji, and Tracy Shukart on deck. For Macro Voices Energy Week, I'm Eric Townsend. See you next week, everybody.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.